Hi, everyone. Welcome to an episode of Everything is Canon, a CineLinks podcast, a podcast where we invite marginalized authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. I'm your host, Steve Dunk, and thanks so much for tuning in. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter, of course, at SteveDunk5 or at EverythingCanon. And so, without further ado, let's get the show on the road and meet today's guest. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As is always the case around here, we will continue to encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. A reminder that March is Women's History Month, a time of commemorating and encouraging the study, observance, and celebration of the vital role of women in American history and today. There are several ways you can do this, of course. I suggest listening to women for starters, then go from there. Okay, Amina Mesafi is the author of four novels, including Tell Me How You Really Feel, Not the Girls You're Looking For, and This Is All Your Fault. Her award-winning short stories can be found in Fresh Ink, Freshman Orientation, and Out of Our League, which is due out next year. Her writing has also appeared at Salon and Bustle, and that's the Salon thing I'm going to talk about here in a second. When not writing, she teaches, having taught writing in community settings, conferences, and universities. She currently regularly visits faculty in the low residency MFA program at Antioch University in LA and is an instructor at the UCLA Extension's Creative Writing Department. I hope this is all still true. She's an erstwhile artist.
This is also true.
it's so weird reading by
like a mouthful, yeah. But it's all true.
She's an erstwhile art historian, a fan of Cthulhu popcorn, and an unironic lover of the Fast and the Furious franchise, isn't that kind of the greatest found family story of all time? So she's here today to talk about her latest book, Travelers Along the Way, a Robin Hood remix, which is described as a ragtag band of misfits get swept up in Holy Land politics and Travelers Along the Way by Amina Mesafi, a thrilling YA remix of the classic legend of Robin Hood. I fucking love this book so much. I'm so happy she's here. Please welcome to the show, Amina Mesafi. Hi, Amina.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Oh my gosh, you can't see me, but I'm blushing now.
I enjoy it. We're going to I want to cover one sort of more serious topic, but when we get to it, I've had Bethany and CB both on the show for their books as well. I fucking love this series. So every book is a banger. It's insane.
So different too. Isn't that so fun?
I just had Anna Marie on the show and they were telling me about, they were sort of peppering me, getting me ready for their book. And I'm just like, oh my God, Anna Marie, I can't fucking wait to read that.
And their writing is so lyrical. And yeah. We're all just sitting here like, give me the book. Give me the book.
That's right. I know. Like,
give me.
Yeah, that's right. And like, because I'm kind of like a weird, like I love process. I'm such a huge fan of process and I'm like, I love research and they were telling me about some of the research they had to do for their story. And I can't wait. Anyways. So
they and I share we both editors. So we both worked on our first books with our first editor and then worked with our editor Emily on this one, and it was very fun to be texting with them and just like, oh, this is how like Emily does it versus Kat does it, and like they're both great editors, and it's like fun to have someone else who like knows what it is to have a history with one person and then like build a rapport with another, and like it was fun to text and talk about research with them too. I'm also a big process nerd, so
that's so much fun, isn't it? Have you read Lake Lore yet?
No, I haven't. I actually love to save their books for when they come out. I know that that's like a funny thing, but
no, that's cool.
I think you get access to books when they're early, and that's so special. And there are some books that I like. I've been trying to retrain myself, actually, being an author, working in the industry, and giving myself space for pleasure while reading again, not just feeling like, oh, this is work, I need to do it before it comes out, and to instead be like, you know what, I'm a fan of this person. And sometimes when you're a fan of a person, you still get to read their books early, and that's a delight. And sometimes it's fun to wait and feel like you're in that bucket of fandom where you're like, I'm anticipating this thing and I don't get to have it yet, and I'm gonna go purchase it from an indie and I'm gonna sit down and read it on my couch. Like, I love preserving those spaces for myself, because I didn't at first, and it was not fun to read. And I was like, I don't want to live like this. I want to keep writing books. I want to still love to read, particularly the authors that I've loved for a really long time.
So. Right. Especially when it's, you know, someone like them or any author that you adore or love, or a story, or just a story that you're just really looking forward to. And because we're all readers, we get really fucking particular about the way we read books about, right. About like the time of day, the position you're in, the room you're in, if it's a chair, couch, or just laying on the floor, and but whatever, right? Whatever the situation is. And so, yeah, it gets real strange. So, I mean, it's because I'm, you know, blogging and all these other things. I read so far ahead. So, oftentimes, like, you know, I get these books months, sometimes a year ahead of release. Mm-hmm. So, which again, I never take for granted. I'm very appreciative and very fortunate and very lucky that it, you know, people give me anything, but
give you something you already love, yeah, and to read. Yeah.
So, you know, I always make sure to go out, especially, you know, the books I really, really like, that for sure, obviously go buy a hardcover when they come out, and we'll, you know, really enjoy digging into it again. And yeah,
are you a rereader?
What's that?
Are you a rereader?
Yes, I am. I'm trying to think, like, I'm just trying to come up with a number here, like a percentage. It's not huge. It's not a big number. Only because, again, I'm reading so far.
You get so many. Yeah, you get so many books. But I was wondering, I was talking with another author about this. Tasha Shuri, who's also in the Remix series.
Yes. She's doing. Oh, I know. I can't wait.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
But we were talking about how we were both big rereaders, but we haven't been able to have time. And I've switched to audio for rereading.
So I can reread. Okay.
Yeah, because we have the same thing where we're like, we get so many great books, and also like we still love to like go revisit. It's like revisiting a past self, really.
Rereading is actually my slump buster. So I use that for that. Smart. For sure. Yeah, but also I've reread a lot of books, like just the kind of by accident. So like, for example, I've reread your book, this one, ooh, Travelers Along the Way, because there was a couple things I wanted to look at, right, to remind myself, because I read it so long ago. I'm like, there's a couple of key points that I wanted to reread just to refresh my memory. I ended up rereading the whole book. So it's
so compliment of all time.
Yeah. So there's instances where that happens for sure. And then there are just some cases where, yeah, it's either whether it's slump busting or whatever, I do, but yeah, it's not a big number though, I don't think. But again, I'm also reading over 200 books a year, so it's hard to It gets tough. And also like, I have issues, like closure issues for sure. And I need to, this is something I need to fix. Actually, I need to make more time and go back and read past releases that I haven't read. That's something I'm terrible at.
It's like it passes the deadline in your brain. And so you're like,
well, I'm already into 20, whatever, yep. Third quarter of whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard. It's really hard. And especially if it's a series, forget it. It stands almost no chance, because it's just hard. Anyways,
it is. Yeah. That's why I love audiobooks for real. Cause it just makes the accessibility point for my brain. Cause it's still reading. And it also means I can do it while I'm like going for a walk around the neighborhood. Right. Like,
yes. Yeah.
As much as I wanted to be Belle as a kid walking around with a book, you know, I don't like getting hit by Los Angeles cars.
Well, that was it. Imagine there would be so many more deaths and injuries if people, yeah, like, right? Like, it's get yelled at enough for the way I walk around with my either head in the clouds or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so something I did want to talk to you about, only because it's relevant and it's always relevant, and it's, I'm actually in the middle of putting together a book banning roundtable for Weedy Diverse Books. And it's just been, because it's been trending a lot lately. I just wondered if you've got any. I mean, it's bad. I know we know it's, but to me, it's like a four alarm kitchen fire. Like, this is an emergency beyond, you know. I want people to take it seriously. I know there are people taking it seriously, but I want people to take it more seriously. So I'm just sort of in the middle of putting together this roundtable. So I'm always thinking about it. What are your thoughts? Do you have anything new to add that maybe somebody else hasn't said yet, or are you just as dismayed as the rest of us?
I am dismayed. I think it's always hard. It was really hard to see the images of that that group burning books. Like, that really hit in a really dark place, I think, visually, right? Your brain just goes to a very dark place when you see people throwing books into the fire. I don't know that I have anything new to add. I think the thing that I always find disturbing and fascinating, and this is, I think, the historian in me or the art historian in me, is the ways in which when people ban books, it becomes the ways in which ideas become materialized. Like the idea that what's in a book can be burned and therefore destroyed, which when we're talking about written records, absolutely does happen. I'm thinking of, like, you know, the history of, say, like Mesoamerica getting burned by the Spanish, right? Or the history of the Incans being burned, and we don't have that written record. So you can wipe whole records out in this way. And at the same time, I always think, like, an idea lives in your mind. Like the power of a book is always that someone wrote something down, shared a story with you, shared an idea with you. And I guess this is also why I love libraries, is like, you can return that book to the library. Let's not go to like burning it right away, but you can return that book and someone else can have that idea. And it's in you and it lives in your brain now, and you think about it. And I think that's why I find it so disturbing that someone wants to control and destroy that, because it's not just the material book. It's that, like, someone's trying to burn the future potential in someone's mind, and someone's basically trying to transgressively burn it back into someone who's also read it. Like, if you think about, like, what that book holds and the idea that, like, you're trying to burn that out of everyone's brain is deeply insidious. My spark of hope is that we do live in the world of, you know, Al Gore's internet, and you can't quite wipe knowledge in the same way. That's my little match that's on fire. That's my little hope match of, you know, this is very serious. This should be taken very seriously. And also, kids have the internet. Like, kids have resources that we didn't have, that you had to get in a book, that you don't have to get in a book anymore. And I think that's why we should also be sounding alarm bells, is because if they start with burning books, like, do they want to start throttling certain sites on the internet? Do they want to start shutting down what we can and can't see?
Like, of course.
That's,
yeah,
dark. Well, that's like, I think that's when you can really hear, I think that might help people who are like, well, it's a book. And you're like, but what if they were, because the book is a manifestation of knowledge. Like, the book is a site of knowledge. So, like, do you want them to throttle the libraries, like, the blackout books from your digital collection? Do you want them to blackout being able to access certain Twitch streams? Do you want them to blackout being able to watch certain things on Netflix? Like, that happens places. Like, that
happens here. That happens here. Like, there's yeah. You know, every yeah.
Yeah. I think that's where it's like that's where you need to, like, start thinking about however present the idea of banning a book is, because it's throttling knowledge and information. I think when you think about the ways in which we live in an age of information and knowledge, it can.
They are absolutely right.
Real for people.
Right. They are.
Does that make sense?
It makes 100% sense. They are absolutely right now trying to figure out ways to erase all of this from the internet as well. There's mm-hmm. there's no doubt in my mind, and they already do it. And there's already, like, I mean, terms of service and all these stupid things we hear about, right? Like, they're already controlling the narrative. They already control most of the press. They already control the way we get information, you know, whether it's digitally or however. So yeah, book burning is just like, is just like, this is like a practice session for them just to see how fucking much they can get away with, which they're getting away with a lot right now. And they're not even trying to hide it. It's so obvious. I mean, you look at these lists and you can tell right away what's going on here. Yeah, two things for me is, it's always insane to me when someone is trying to control the knowledge base for a group of people they will never, ever meet. Like, there's decisions being yep. made. There's decisions being made about what type of books can be read in a school or checked out in a library states away from for kids. They'll never know. They'll never meet. Mm-hmm. That's insane to me. And also, books are very much written in the time in which we exist. Right. I mean, a lot of times authors are, you know, you're writing what you see at your front window. So that's history. They're erasing history. They're trying to.
They're trying to erase history. They're trying to erase,
like our history, right? The now, yep. the right. The, whether it's a contemporary book or not,
they're trying to rewrite it as it's happening, which is
right. Yeah, because and again, because it's like it's fucking, it's just fear, right? It's fear. Mm-hmm. It's all this shit. So anyways,
it is a fear response for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And
it's people stoking a fear response, which is, I think, disturbing to me is the idea that it's centered around critical race theory, which is like a theoretical model at the university level or higher. And you're like, well, no one would teach that to a child. Like that's not an elementary school range. It's the same way. Like I wouldn't have them like read about like Capital or even like the idea of the free market is not something I would give to an 8-year-old, regardless of how they feel about it. Like it's just, it doesn't make sense to an 8-year-old, even a very smart one.
This is
you don't need another theoretical model for it's just, it's like such a made up boogeyman. And what's so wild.
This
is like, I don't want to go on that train to like debate you in a place that like, I'm already leaving like a zone of sanity to talk to you about that over there. Like that's a wild place to go. And I'm not joining you over there. You can come here and we can talk like civilized adults, because that's where you're acting like a toddler in a playpen that isn't getting their toys.
Well, this is how organized they are, because they've convinced a large percentage mm-hmm. of the population mm-hmm. to ban something that doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. That's like, so
to your point, right? They've literally convinced a huge uh-huh. portion of the populace that they need to get organized and rally and vote people in who will ban critical race theory at the school level, which isn't taught at the school level. It doesn't exist. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't exist.
This is classic for them. Right. And this is like, you know, we all know, because like, you know, the fear center of the brain, the amygdala part of the brain, is overdeveloped in a lot of these people. And you don't need to be a genius to look at the messaging, and it's all fear-based, and it's, you know,
fear is a contagious human emotion.
Absolutely.
Like we all experience fear on some level, and we can all have the fear. Anyone can have the fear button pushed. And I think that it's really important to think about that as like a universal human emotion. I think that's why, like, I always think of comedy as like such a beautiful response, because I think comedy can take something seriously and also help remove the power structure underneath that. I think that's why I always love to laugh and find the ridiculousness in it. Not because it's not serious, because I think it's deadly serious. But because I think sometimes when someone is leveraging and abusing power in that way, there is a great, catharsis is the wrong word, but there is a great moment of sort of upending that power relationship when you find the ridiculous in someone wielding and abusing power in that way and laughing at them. Like I always think of that moment when Jon Stewart like basically got Crossfire taken off the air.
Because
it took the power out of that structure, and it made it so ridiculous. No one could take it seriously. And I think that is why I love comedy so much, not because it doesn't take things seriously. Because sometimes people don't, but because if you can marry that idea of like, this is very serious, and also I'm going to ridicule you in this moment so that you can't do this to other people. Like there is something so beautiful about someone trying to wield fear and you instead laughing at them that I love. And I think I got from my father's side, which is like that dark comedy.
I deal like with tragedy, with humor constantly, like inappropriately so sometimes, to your point, what you're doing there is you're literally taking the knife out of their hand. Right. Mm-hmm. And then what, they don't even realize it until they look down and their hands are empty. And they're like, what the fuck happened to my knife? And mm-hmm. then,
or they're holding a rubber chicken, which is even right.
Or
like I slapped it.
or like some fake dog poop or something.
It is. It's even funnier. Right. And then they squeeze it and it's just, we're all laughing at them. And I think there's something beautiful about that. You can't always do it. Not every situation allows for you to do it. I understand that. But that's always my favorite way.
Yeah, totally agree. No, totally, totally.
Preferred methodology.
We're the same. No, we're the same. We're the same. But anyways, yeah, I wanted to just sort of get talking a little bit in there, because I want to try and bring it up as much as we can and make sure people understand how serious it is and what it, mm-hmm. and to sort of what you were getting at earlier, it like, this is, you know, for them, this is phase one. And if you're scared of phase one, you're not going to fucking like phase two and three. I'll tell you that. So let's get on this thing. Like I was sort of saying to you earlier, I am a front matter, back matter, everything in between. I read everything in a book. And I especially, because I like process so much, I especially love like letters to the reader. I love author's notes. I love acknowledgements. I love all that stuff. I get really emotional reading your acknowledgements. Yeah, my eyes welled up a couple of times, actually. It's written really well, of course, but it's very heartfelt. It's very meaningful. And you talk about cancer. And so, yes, and I want to know how you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm doing really well. I am past my second surgery, and I had a complete response to the chemo. And now we're kind of at the phase where I get to recover and do blood draws. And it just so far just healing, knocks on wood, but knocking on my head. But, you know, I'm approaching the 1 year mark for my first surgery. And that's kind of like one of those big milestones. Everyone's feeling good. I'm feeling good. The doctors are really confident. But you know, they continue to monitor, they continue to do the checkups and blood draws and everything. But that response, it just puts me in a really different risk category. Mm-hmm. And I just, so much of that is luck, right? Like I was in network at a place where I got referred to a person, a doctor who had just written a paper on the type of cancer that I had had and the type of breast cancer that I'd had. And the treatment is a funny drug chemo cocktail that was basically every doctor that uses it. When you look into the scientific papers and the research, they're like, every doctor that uses it knows that it works, knows that you're getting more complete responses out of patients. But it's just still not widely used. And I just happened to be somewhere where they used it, happened to be somewhere where I was covered in a network at this major research institution, by being in Los Angeles and by being by UCLA. And I had just a kind of ideal, perfect response. And my oncologist too was like, this is the treatment we laid out. But it was considered a risk because not everyone thinks it works yet. Cause that's how science works. Right.
Yep.
So I feel like I got there's a saying that my whole family always says, which is better lucky than good. And every time I'm just like better lucky than good, you know? But for a letter that was forwarded on my dad's first like work job here, his residency that he's accepted for, got sent to Baghdad, India. So it's like, I exist because some postal worker in India saw that letter was going somewhere that didn't exist and took the time in their day to forward it back on to Iraq. And I think about that because like we all have days we show up to work and we're just like over it. And we're like, that's going in the do not deliver pile. Like, I don't care anymore. Like, I'm tired. I got to go home. It's my lunch break. Like, we've all been there. And the idea that they like stopped and went, that isn't here. Is there a forward pile I can put this in to send it to the correct location? And like that changed the entire course of my dad's life. And the fact that I exist, like he would have probably gone to England, tried to set up a practice in England. You know, he wouldn't have met my mom here. And it feels like the same thing where it's just like, I sort of lucked into good care. And then the combination of, you know, being of a generation of young women who was taught to do like a breast check every month, and I found a lump and then I went in time. Like, it's just a weird series of, on the one hand, I have no risk factors and it was very unlucky and extremely unlikely to be 33 and get breast cancer with no genes, no family history, no nothing. But on the other, it feels bonkers lucky that I got the best treatment possible and I got the best outcome possible. And now I get to recover and, you know, bitch about my eyelashes growing back in. Like, what a beautiful place to be. Yeah, I know it is. Yeah. It's like, I'm like,
oh,
no,
so yeah, happy. That's great. Yeah, yeah. It's the
knowing little, out of me right now.
the little things. Yeah.
It's a funny.
Well,
funny thing.
It sounds like sounds like a lot of optimism going around, and that I can't tell you how happy I am to hear that you're doing better.
Yeah.
It is like, I mean, cancer, it's like my father couple of aunts, uncle, like it's decimated my family for sure. Yeah, yeah. It's everywhere. It's everywhere, right? Like it's so insane. So
and it touches everyone in a different way.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
It's hard to, I always say, like, I didn't have to watch myself go through treatment, right? Like I had to show up and that was its own kind of hard, but I didn't have to witness watching that myself go through that in the way that people who loved me did. And that's a very different burden to carry, and it's its own burden. And I'm sorry you've had to do that.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's okay. And just the cancer in particular, the treatment in particular is just really hard, isn't it? And mm-hmm. and it's just like, it's really soul sucking, and obviously the physical and toll it takes on you. And, but it's just, you know, it's an incredible thing to go through, and I'm so happy to hear you sound bright and eager and ready to continue and, you know, live your life to the fullest. So that makes me very, very happy. I'm very happy for you. So
thank you.
Continued success and trust in modern medicine and
research science is dope.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, a little blind faith in something or someone now and again is a good thing too, but mm-hmm. For sure in moderation, that's all I would say. And but
yeah, no, I had to believe it was going to be okay. And I'm going to get that. I mean, I had no idea. And I knew that, like, there was obviously the intellectual part of your brain that's like, you literally can't know that. I'm like,
yeah.
The belief part of my brain has decided and you're getting on the train now.
I love it. I love it. So yeah, it's great, great, great news. And so the other part in the acknowledgements is you talk about your Baba and some family history, and you talk about your great aunts who, quote, walked the streets unchaperoned and armed during the early 20th century, who when catcalled, turned around, pointed their weapons at offenders' balls and told the man to say that again to her face. Mm-hmm. And you know, the stories of Bebe wrestling snakes with her bare hands, of Ama Hukum leaving her marriage when she was done with it and deciding she would stay with every family member she felt like for as long as she felt like it. So you've got like this awesome fucking like proud mm-hmm. history of strong women in your family. I mean, there's like three book ideas right there, right? So I mean, yeah. You're good. You're good for stories, for inspiration. I have to think, I mean, this is, you tell me, so this, I'm not going to read the summary. I don't read summaries on here. People can look that up. But this book is about sisters. It's about found family, mm-hmm. but it's about sisters and two, mm-hmm. you know, these sisters in particular. And, you know, you have this great history of proud, strong women in your family. And I got to think that had a huge factor in this story. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was funny. It came out while I was writing because I love found family, as you know, with the Fast and the Furious. I love the idea that you pick up your family and you build one. And that's from, you know, moving from Texas and having to build a life out here in California. And I think also being the child of an immigrant and watching my dad do that, where I had aunties and uncles who were not my relations by blood, but immigrants do that, where they find and build their own communities in their new homes, in their new lands, so that they're kids have that similar extended network, and so that they have that sense of community around them. And I think that's always been so beautiful to me, that people do that and build that, and that so many communities do that, and so many people who feel like they were cast out or left their homeland or home for any reason often find these found communities and build them and have these very strong bonds. And I also think we pick our family too. I mean, we don't pick our family by blood, but when we are given family by blood, we don't just get that relationship. We have to tend to it the way we tend to the found families we have. And I was thinking about that bond of what happens when you do keep picking your sister. Like, you pick these other people who are part of your family, and also your sister who drives you crazy, who is so different from you, which is so fun to have like a chaos good and a justice good, who in many ways believe the same things, but will always go about it in a radically different ways. And will always bicker and fight about that, but they keep picking each other and they keep deciding that they are kin and family in a way that I think is really beautiful. And I think maybe for me, there's always an action verb in the heart of love and in the heart of family, that it is not it is not something you just are handed. It's also something you work and tend to. And maybe that is growing up the child of an immigrant and knowing how hard, especially the older I get. I remember talking to my dad about this because I always send all of my family on all sides. I try to send them birthday cards if I can or birthday messages. And I think about how hard my dad worked to make sure that our family that experienced this massive diaspora, right? Like, I have family in America that's in Texas. I'm here in California. I have family in the Republic of Georgia. I have family in Canada. I have family still in Iraq. I've had family also living in Egypt and Dubai. And like the idea that we haven't lost track of each other is a great force of will. And there's almost always one or two people at the center, just like holding everyone together. And I think for a really long time in my childhood, my dad made that feel invisible. Or there were times where I thought, why are you tolerating this behavior from someone? And I realized that he was putting his ego aside to make sure that families weren't lost and fallen off the branches of the tree because we experienced this sort of large scale button push of diaspora that wasn't in any of our hands, right? Like that wasn't something we actively chose, but is something we have to live with. So I think that's part of why I love found families and sisterhood and picking sisterhood. And then I just, growing up, I never knew that Muslim women were considered oppressed because I hadn't grown up with any Muslim women who weren't in charge. Someone was talking about how they're like, I'm not intimidated by many people, but I was definitely intimidated by Bibi, your grandmother. And like, I felt like she could have literally killed me and like, I would have gone to hell and she would have gone to heaven. And like, she would like, she has that energy of just like, she had so much authority and so much of a sense of self and her own roots and who she was. And those were the women of my family. And it felt really important to put them in this book. And it felt really important to put the women I saw and the Muslim women that I saw who had been in charge in so many ways and who had, I don't think power always comes from knowing how to fight, but the idea that they knew how to fight and they were in charge of their lands and in charge of their homes in a non-Victorian domestic sense. Like it's so hard to find the language in English because it comes with all this other baggage, but that was what I grew up with as an example of what women were and could be. And they were all throughout my father's side. And so when I got older and I realized that like, that was not how Muslim women were perceived, I think it's always sort of rattled in the back of my head of like, that isn't who we are though. Like that is just this one narrative that people have taken hold of and constantly put out there. And I really wanted to show this other Muslim woman and these other women who would fit in the category of like, this is a Muslim woman. And they have a very strong sense of what they're capable of. They have a very strong sense of who they are and how they move through the world and what that means. And particularly when you're talking about a medieval idiom, like they have a lot more rights of authority, power, movement, inheritance, property than, you know, women in the Christian world in Europe at the time. And that felt really important to like shine that spotlight on. That so much of the regressive conservatism of what we see now is because we invaded these regions, destabilized them, and, you know, basically wiped out all of the left wing. So they either died or they fled. And then we wonder why it's so regressive and conservative in these places. It's like, it's very strange to watch, right? Like I've seen it even when people are talking about Afghanistan. And this was years ago, I think on Tumblr, where someone was saying like, well, it's always been like that. And someone had to come in and be like, here's images of Afghanistan in the 60s, right? Like here's like, these are women with their mod haircuts and their mini skirts. And that isn't always, that's one version of freedom for some people and not for others. But the idea that it's always been this way and we've kind of projected it out back into the past of the situation we've largely created is maddening. I mean, when my dad came here as a resident for surgery, he didn't understand why there weren't any women doctors in the 70s, because he graduated med school in Baghdad in the 60s and half of his graduating class was women, or like 46%, almost half. And then here it was like less than 10, 20% of women were doctors. And they certainly weren't surgeons at the time. They were certainly shut out from by the boys club. And that didn't make sense to him. Or he read Sense and Sensibility for the first time when he was a teenager, and he didn't understand how women could be shut out of their rights of inheritance, because that doesn't exist in Islam. Now we can talk about ways in which that inheritance should be more equal or not, but that the idea of not having a right of guaranteed property and inheritance simply didn't exist from the 7th century onwards in Islam. And it's all of these ideas that are fundamental to a culture that we think of as particularly bad for women, when we're just used to our flavor of patriarchy, I think, is a lot of it. And it's really easy to point the finger and say, how dare you be like this?
Right. Well, it also, it's
doing
right.
That same thing here.
Right. Well, it also gets confusing.
Kind of my soapbox probably.
No, it's perfect. And it's also, it gets really, the waters get a little muddy for us, you know, less enlightened white folks here in North America, because we're sold a bill of goods on what Muslims are and what they are not, and Islam, what Islam is and what it is not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you bother to read a thing or two, or heaven forbid, talk to a Muslim person about it, you know, you start to learn that, you know, you realize the history is full of just like bad political actors too, right? A lot of these decisions aren't theistic in nature. Yeah. They were made by politically motivated men who want the same thing men have wanted forever, right? Power, mm-hmm. power, money, land, you know, treat women like a certain way, all these things. So it's only then when you get deeper into it that you realize what's really going on here. And to your point, this concept of what a good and healthy society looks like for women is like everything else in the fucking world. It's different, and it's not always going to look like maybe your flavor, but it doesn't mean there isn't an inherently great thing about it.
Yeah.
And, right. And when you talk to
them, or like the story that you were told, right, is missing some pretty big pieces of information, possibly.
like say, for example, history is a record of what did not happen.
Oh.
If I had like a segue sound effect, it would play right there. Yeah. It's like bing, bing, bing.
Yeah. Anyway. I was like a little chime.
But I don't want to get away from this question though, because I am such a huge fan of process. So, but I do want to, we are going to get back into the sisters and a couple of things, and in particular a couple of things you said in a wonderful Salon piece you wrote. But I do want to talk about Robin Hood just for a second here, because that's this whole retelling series is remixing. It's wonderful. So I we've spoken to the other author, a couple of the other authors authors already, so I understand how the deal went down. But so when you first, you know, so you're getting Robin Hood, you know, this is, you're like, I'm gonna do Robin Hood, it's gonna be women and Muslim driven. Obviously there's a million other things going on too, but that's primarily what you were thinking. But it's Robin Hood. So what's your source material? What was your main go-to for source material? And what did you decide, what was important right away, and what could be thrown out right away?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Put a dime in this jukebox, I'm going to really let the whole song play out. So you've probably heard this part, but I have to start here for my brain to like find the thread of the story.
Yeah.
Our editor, Emily, emailed us, I'm assuming individually, and she was like, hey, we're doing this remix classics. And sometimes you get these as an author and you're like, okay, you know, I'll sign the NDA. Tell me what's up. And then it's like, so we're thinking about Robin Hood from the other side of the Crusades. And my whole brain lit up because that was so much of what my thesis in art history focused on. I have a master's degree from the University of Chicago in Islamic art history. And what I focused on was the ways in which we take these medieval stories and we make them into essentially part of the national mythos. And the English did this, the British did this with Robin Hood specifically. But I was talking about sort of Ferdowsi and the Iranian monument to him and the ways in which we try to create this monomyth. But often it's kind of unstable because it exists on all of our minds. And so my brain just lit up because I love the medieval world. I think the center of the medieval world was at various places, you know, in Western Asia, in Baghdad, in Eastern Asia, in say Karakoram or in the Yurchin Empire, in West Africa, in Ghana, like in North Africa. Like there's all of these hubs of the world that existed in the medieval age that we don't get because we just get, and I'm not taking a stab at Game of Thrones, but we just get that like, and I love Lord of the Rings. Okay, we just get that like Lord of the Rings, medieval Europe in this very specific moment when like, that was a side backwater in terms of like global power. And I'm not speaking to the Americas because I have not as much history of where those centers of the world were when we're speaking about the Americas. And I don't want to just like wallpaper over that either. But it felt so important to understand that the medieval world was global and interconnected. I mean, even the idea of the Silk Road comes from essentially having this Pax Mongolica where you interconnected trade networks from all the way on sort of the South China Sea, all the way across through the desert, through the mountains, across a continent on and into the Mediterranean again, right? Like the idea that we were trading goods and materials and ideas across this network, like tells you that we've always been seeking this sort of complicated global connection that is not necessarily perfect in and of itself, but it felt so important to show the global medieval world. And while, yes, there were sites that were more monolithic or more homogenous, a lot of that is much like our own world where, you know, cities are much more cosmopolitan outside country land where you have more space. It tends to be more homogenous. And I had a medieval professor talk about this, about how we aren't smarter than we used to be. We just think about things differently. And that felt so cool to get that opportunity to say, I'm not smarter than someone in the Middle Ages. We just happen to live in a world where we have secular humanism and they didn't. So like the ways in which they see science is different than the way I see science. But like science was never in opposition to religion in medieval Islam, the way it was in medieval Christianity. So they are considered part of like, so doing science in certain medieval idioms is part of like sort of understanding God's bounty and coming at it from that angle of like every single person in this group of people is so fun to think about how they could have existed in this world. Think about how they think about their world differently than I do. Think about how they think about the world differently than we all do and make that feel present and contemporary because they're still grappling with globalism. They're still grappling with being a refugee, they're grappling with war, they're grappling with invasion, they're grappling with conquest and colonies. And like, that's still stuff we grapple with. And that felt so modern. And then I have always loved Robin Hood and I've always loved the legend of Robin Hood. And I grew up first seeing, as many kids do, the Disney, or as many American kids do, the Disney Fox Robin Hood. And I went into it from a very historiographic perspective. God, that's such a mouthful. If that word feels so pretentious, but it's the only one that works. It's just like, oh, I can't, it's just like, ugh. I can break out in hives thinking about it. It's like I have a flashback to being in a library or something in a non-fun way. There's a fun library setting and there's like, oh God, I'm late on my paper setting. But historiographically, it's a tale that was an oral tale. And it started with bards and it started with sort of short vignettes that could be passed along orally by these singer storytellers. And it kept accruing things, which is fun. So there are some characters like say the Guy of Gisborne or the Sheriff of Nottingham who are pretty steady features. Will Scarlet Scarlock, like as a kinsman of Robin, are these very set features that have been there the whole time. But Maid Marian is when they started telling these tales at May Day festivals. And she's the May Queen, essentially. And it's funny that she and Friar Tuck come in at the same time because it's like you have Robin in this romance with the May Queen. which is very pagan. So then they're like, no, it's religious. Here's Friar Tuck. And then you also have these stories become more of a romance because of the Crusades themselves and because, you know, European Christians and largely Frankish and Norman Europeans come into contact with the Arabic and Persian tradition of poetry and of these epic poetic love stories. I'm thinking of like Shireen and Khosrow is like a good example, or like Leila wa Majnun. So you have like that tradition marrying, and it like infuses the idea of courtly love and longing and chivalry and honor into these stories. And then you start writing it down and you start getting these vignettes that get written down. And then we start adding this history component. We're like, no, this guy was real. This guy was real. He's definitely this guy, which we start doing like in like Shakespeare's era. And then you get Ivanhoe and Sir Walter Scott being like, no, he was a third crusader. He rode with or fought with Richard the Lionheart. And you get this like story that just keeps picking up pieces. But at its core, it's a story about justice. Like at its core, it's a story that comes from this yeoman who was a representative of the Anglo-Saxons who had been conquered by the Normans. And like, that's kind of the most commonly accepted idea is that Robin is a resistor. He's a resistor to conquest. He's a resistor to the injustice of the Norman apartheid that was essentially enacted on the Anglo-Saxon population. And so it becomes a story about justice. And it's a story about the world is unjust, but there is someone out there making it more just, even if it's just in a small corner. And I love that that's who Robin Hood is. And I love that there's this someone doing good in a world that we can acknowledge isn't always good, but they're willing to do that. And they're willing to fight for that. And then we've added all these layers. And so it felt in this way that the legend itself was a series of vignettes that build to a larger story. And the way the legend itself had built was a series of vignettes that build to a larger story. And it felt like that framework was important. And it felt like having a good chaotic hero who was fighting for justice and who wasn't the biggest or the strongest, but was the cleverest and willing to keep trying even when all hope seemed lost was important. And it felt like it was fun to have all of these archetypes of characters that you could play with if you wanted, but that you didn't have to be precious with the legend itself because no one had been precious with the legend itself because everyone had come in and just been like, no, it's actually a romance and he's marrying the Maid Queen and her name is Maid Marian. No, it's actually a historical thing. No, this is actually about like England's mythos and like the national character of England. Like everyone's doing this. So it felt really fun to feel like there's this underlying structure that we kind of love, which is like short vignettes that make sense to our brain because it started as an oral story that build into this big arc. But otherwise, you know, it's a little bit of a free for all as long as you're confident enough in how you're doing it. As long as you're like, no, I am correct. No. You got to start with that energy, I feel like, with Robin Hood, which, right, you know, is Robin Hood themselves, really. Robin's right. Like, no, I got this.
Right. It always struck me as
don't
being
a worry.
It always struck me as being a story where Robin Hood say like it changes from you're fighting for someone versus fighting for something, right?
Yes.
And you know, that's very much, we've always been sold this idea that Robin Hood was fighting for someone. Now that's someone, one person or someone, a group of people, whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was always the interesting thing that I took from it too, even growing up, how that, you know, on paper you're like, well, that sounds like a completely reasonable thing to do. Why are these people? Why do these people want to arrest him? Why do these people want to, you know,
Right.
So you start, that's how my young brain is like, starts thinking about these things. And when you don't have any answers, because there aren't any, well, I mean, the answers are insidious and whatever, but that's when you really start to embrace this idea of putting together a group of people, regardless of their differences, coming together to fight for, again, someone, which then morphs into fighting for something, AKA charity, you know, pride, whatever,
justice, family,
the helping the poor, you know, feeding from the rich, feeding the poor, all these things. And that's, but it starts with this idea of just one person fighting for someone as opposed. So I was always.
And it's sort of it was fun to take this idea too, because it feels like in many ways it could be a really conservative story because if you look at the original archetype, it's someone fighting to restore their status quo, right? Mm-hmm. Like Robin fighting to restore his original lands is basically like, I want to go back and restore the status quo. So how do you then make it a story that's actually about someone who wants the status quo and to restore it, but then in, goes on this journey and instead finds something bigger than that to push forward on, was a really satisfying problem to think about.
Right. And also this idea of going off to war and coming back a changed person, right? Mm-hmm. That's an incredibly important part because that it comes up in this book, in your book as well. So we have, yeah, so that this, and you've also taken, you've also gone some sort of like a central lead. Rama is certainly the lead character, but this is very much, like I said, the sisters. And there's two wonderful lines. One is, tell me who you love and I will love them too. I love that part. Mm-hmm. And in the epilogue, you know, for she is my sister and I am hers and we belong together. It's so wonderful. And so it's such an incredible relationship they have. This idea, you wrote this really great thing in Salon. I don't remember the date of it. It was a couple of years ago, I think, right? And you talk about sort of, you know, I'll just quote you. To know there is a story the world tells about you, a story of violence, extremism, oppression, without knowing you, without any full sense of the facts, is a weight that most Muslim Americans live with. And I want to give the next generation of Muslim stories where they can see themselves not just as the victims of hate, but as the instigators of love. This is all about, to me, controlling, you know, taking back your own narrative, right? Controlling your own fate. And that very much describes this sort of group that you've put together. So, you know, you've put together this wonderful team in this book led by these two sisters. And they are about, as you know, an eclectic mix of people.
They were fun. They were fun to get together.
and to, you know, sort of to a lot of the things you just said of the time. Yep. Is right. Mm-hmm. This makes them, the sisters in particular, extremely progressive to be this, because there's no, again, this is now just how we're sold this in North America, but we're sold this idea that especially Muslims, you know, is the followers of Islam and are very judgmental, right? Like, yes, it's our way or the highway. It's one God, yeah. you know, go down the list of things, but mm-hmm. but that just isn't true. Because you're not a monolith like fucking anything else on the planet.
Right.
And so
it'd be like saying Catholics and Protestants believe the exact same thing. And I'm sure someone just screamed on the other end of this podcast.
And no, listen, if you listen to the show before, it's anything goes. And these sisters are very much of that idea that certain things make the world go round. And, you know, there's a running sort of thing, certainly from Rama, where she constantly says, like, in a land with too many names for God or something like that. Yep. I screwed it up. So she makes these offhanded comments like this that are so profound in a way, because not only does it speak to her own belief, but also that she's very much in acknowledgement that it's one big sort of mixed bag of nuts here, isn't it? And so it's wonderful when you put this team together, like you've got a Jew, a polytheist, a Christian, mm-hmm. you know, a Sheehan spy, you've got like, and then you break those down even further, you know, you've got Mongolian and all these different Andalusian, all these different things. Mm-hmm. To me,
a healer, a scientist, a warrior, a tank. Like, it was fun. It was fun to think about in all of these different axes, right? Like, you're thinking about like, who's going to raid the dungeon crew, right? What skills does everyone have? Like, what perspectives does everyone come with? Like, it was a fun mix to like play with. And I think it's because I am mixed. So like the idea that like, we're not any one identity and we all carry all of these identities. And it felt really fun to include so many types of identities and so many types of people on the team. And it's always so rewarding to see readers who see who they identify with, because sometimes it is like, oh my gosh, I'm Muslim and I got to see myself. And sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, I'm a scientist and I love that there's this scientist here, right? Like, and everyone sees their first identity marker first, and them getting to pick that rather than my telling them what's the most important is very cool and very, very rewarding.
It's also a really fun, practical storytelling device, isn't it? Because you get a lot of points of view across in a single conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, you know, I hope people will, if they don't know much about it, will take it as a learning opportunity, because you do actually inject a little bit of information. Like, you drop a lot of exposition in these conversations they have about each other's points of view, about their belief systems, about where they're from, why they're there, all these mm-hmm. wonderful things. And before I get to the, I'll let you go here in a couple of minutes, but I just want to make sure.
Over. I want to make sure you get all the questions you wanted to talk about.
I won't have time. We don't have that much time. and I want to make it clear before we move on that I am 100% team Viva. So I want everyone to understand.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I love finding.
Yeah, yeah. Because
I just gotta explode things.
I can't even tell you. Just like. So charming, so lovely. Of course, you know, another character falls in love with her because I did too. And Viva probably has one of the best introductions in a book I've ever read. Thank you. when they meet her, I mean, my God, that scene is so funny. Again, this sort of comes back to Robin Hood. Robin Hood does put together a team, right? Of some key players. He puts together a key. He's got his key people, right? So, you know, just talk about this as more of a process question. So you're sort of mapping this thing out, and none of this feels like you're checking boxes either. By the way, there's no none of it feels like derived or anything. It felt very natural at the time because at the time during the Crusades, it was a fucking clusterfuck of ideas and people and beliefs though, right? Because
like that's one of the saddest legacies of the Crusade. And that's why I think I always want to dismantle this idea first of capital H history, but also, you know, we have this bedtime story we get over here in America and Europe, and this idea that like it was the Christian West, which is made up. But you're like, because even there were plenty of people who were not Christian in Europe. Like there are plenty of Jewish people. But like, we're like, the Christian West came and fought for the Holy Land from the Muslim East, and they conquered it for a bit and then were repelled and ousted. And like, that's like the story we get. But I keep saying the other side, because the other side that we get from the Crusades, because that idea of there being a Muslim monolith is not real. Like there were, you know, Orthodox or Georgian or Armenian Christians who fought on both sides, depending on whether or not they welcomed having someone of their same religion, or if they were tired of being subjugated by essentially foreign rule, which is because the invaders were largely Frankish and Norman, and the Normans were very good at conquering and sort of enforcing this idea of apartheid where they were the ruling class and no one else got any power, which was not great for the local Christians. There were also, you know, local Sephardic Jews. There were Jewish people from all over the Dar al-Islam, and say coming from Al-Andalus, coming from Andalusia, people coming from North Africa. You know, this is right when you're getting, you know, Temujin or Genghis Khan or Chinggis Khan regrouping and like just starting to unite all of the Mongolian clans under one banner. It's just very pluralistic global moment. And one of the saddest legacies of the Crusades on the whole is that the region, especially the Levantine region, became less Christian. It became less Shiite. It just became less pluralistic due to war, conquest, people having to respond to invaders, and the idea that difference became scary and difference became someone who came in and subjugated you. It was still, and that's still the legacy we have, right? We're like, the plural region that my dad grew up in Baghdad doesn't exist anymore because all of the wars and invasions and bombings and the 20th century politics have, you know, the Jewish people had to flee from Iran. Okay. Like Christians have fled from parts of the south part of Iraq. Some have come back, but many have fled because destabilizing a region and then being in a minority population is not safe. And so you're getting this culture that has been depluralized and made it less safe to be different. And that started in the Crusades. And then we also had a new round of that in the 20th century. And it's actually just the saddest and the worst part for me, because it's a region that was always so vibrant. And it's a region that had this immense history and this deeply rooted history of tolerance. And tolerance isn't always enough, but it's still far more than you've gotten in other places in the same moment. And we never bring those moments up and celebrate them. And it felt so important to lift that up and say, like, this could have happened. And this isn't so antithetical to everyone's commonly held beliefs, right? Like the intermarrying of Christians and Muslims has a patriarchal lean, which is that Muslim men could marry Christian women, but Muslim women couldn't marry Christian men. And that was basically functioning as a not letting the children not be Muslim. And we can talk about like the patriarchal history of that. We can talk about like
Didn't that just change somewhere over there, right, recently? I think.
But like that idea that it wasn't understood as a reality that someone of a different faith could fall in love with someone of a different faith and that they could get married and still be married under the eyes of God wasn't something that existed until the 20th century under Christianity and still doesn't exist in some churches. And the idea that tolerance is antithetical to Islam is, I think, possibly also one of my soapboxes, because it's, we can, again, have a nuanced discussion about what the people of the book mean. And I take a very, very wide view on that. But it was baked into that religion that like there is tolerance for other people's faiths and their beliefs and not proselytizing or changing it or making it exactly like your own. And that was baked into very like center of the line Sunni Islam. Like that was baked into like, you know, middle of the road, not anyone who's like far off in like progressive land either. And that felt really important to show as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the ways you do this actually is really, I thought this was really fucking cool. So this is, again, we talked about, you know, the sisters and mm-hmm. their group, their band of Merry Misfits.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is their point of view. This is the story is driven through them, but you do break away from them and you really give us the political side of what's happening. And as like these different, the chess pieces are moving around the board and you have these wonderful scenes with like Yusuf, and you call him the King of Franj, the Pale King and stuff like this, right? Which is, you know, historically accurate and wonderful to read these scenes. Talk about sort of, you know, there's all this stuff, you know, as this group of misfits moves through this story, it's like they're moving through
history, capital H history,
right? And it's all happening around them. It's happening. Yep. It's happening to them. It's happening around them. It's happening because of them in some instances. But it's like you really do this wonderful job by breaking away from their story to give us a bit more of the bigger picture in real time.
Yeah, and that was fun.
That must have been fun. So that was fun. Talk about that a little bit, and we'll get you out of here on that one though.
Oh, okay. That was fun. It was fun to...
Because that's important, right? That is the historical part of this historical, quote unquote, historical fiction, right? Like that is... Yeah, yeah.
It was fun to bring in history in that way and make it feel personal. And I really wanted to make you feel, with Rahma's character, like I can start with this narrative, because I wanted you to feel as though you were present in the medieval era. I think really great historical fiction plays with the idea of, and I'm a big reader of historical fiction since childhood, making the past feel alive. And what that is sometimes is like taking you in a time machine and showing you how different it was. And that's cool. I love those stories. And then the way that I wanted to do it was take you and insert you in someone's perspective that is radically different from your own, but make it feel familiar. So Rahma's point of view is very much wrapped in the sort of wrapper of that first person present of YA contemporary and making you feel like you're in her point of view. And then I got to take everything that feels familiar and make it feel foreign and take everything foreign and make it feel familiar so that you were moving through space in a different way without having to do any work. Cause I don't want you to work. Like when you're reading, I don't want you to work. Like I love history and I want people to love history. And I feel like we make it really unfun and we make it about dates and we make it about not finding that sense of human connection that's in history that I learned from my father. And so I wanted you to feel that presence. And then it was fun to take this overlay and this framework of like, but capital H history is happening. And it's probably capital H history you have some knowledge of because Richard the Lionheart comes up as a lion in Fox Disney. So it's not like right. I'm pulling from something really esoteric. It's like, we're talking about like Salahuddin or also known as Saladin in English or Yusuf ibn Ayyub. So that was fun too, to like say like, these are characters and their people and their capital H history, like Isabella of Jerusalem, and getting the history in that way where it still feels like it's in these individuated actors' choices. They just, their choices wielded power over so much space. And then putting that in that like third person, like a little more serious tone to like give you that juxtaposition of like, okay, we're going to go in a different place for a second, but it's going to be brief, I promise. And then we'll come back. And then you can see that interplay of like, and we do this every day. Like we do this as we like, we move through our world and then we read a news article and we see that capital H history, that capital P politics. And then we make our individuated choices based on what we've read. And like, we're always living by affecting our own communities, affecting the what we have around us, and also understanding that there's a bigger narrative happening at the same time. And we can be more aware of it or less aware of it, but ultimately it's happening. And like making that feel really present was like just such a fun meta text to play with. And it was such a fun device to bring in history so that you could see it happening without having to have my characters constantly explaining, well, Queen Isabella is on the move. And it was done like, she's mad about a horse, so let's go there. Like that was more fun. Be like, she's mad her horse got stolen. Let's go. Well, rather than like, the report is in. And by the way, I love stories where like, the report is in, the bard is reading it and we must go. You know, I was actually just rewatching The Lord of the Rings, and I think about how amazing it is that like that sequence, the first Fellowship of the Rings, opens with probably one of the greatest, I mean, I've read it too, but I was watching the movies, one of the greatest like narratives over like, oh my gosh, what's voiceover? That's the word. I was like, voiceovers, they tell you never to do in film. They're like, voiceovers are boring and they don't tell you anything. And they're, you know, they're a trick, but like, it's so important there to get you into the head of the fact that you're going back in time into this like fantastical tale. And you want to feel like someone's telling you a bedtime story. Right. So I felt like I could tell you history while also not telling you history. And I could teach you something without making you feel like you were actively learning. And it felt fun.
Well, you need to understand that at that time, especially, everything is in flux, right? Like history is happening, right? In real time. This is like, it's like there's
history still happening. Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's very much like, and it's, but it's like, that is like, you know, such an important time, not of course to that region, but to the world. And it's almost like terraforming in a way, right? Like it's mm-hmm. like, it's like we're watching an active volcano and everything is, everything is happening in real time. It's in flux like today in so many ways.
Yep.
And it really drives home this idea that, yeah, like on Earth, every act is a political one, isn't it? Because I mean, God, even choosing the not only what you eat, but where you eat it from, and or what kind of car you drive, where it was made, or, you know, I'm like, my day is full of decisions because, you know, I shop locally, I'm a vegan. So it's like every, you know, and we eat every day. So every time I'm deliberately making the decision to, you know, omit certain foods from my plate, it's just, it's constant. And so now, take a step back from that and you look at this time in history, the Crusades, and it's just like a fucking, like a powder keg of insanity going on. And that's because like literally the earth is being formed as these decisions are being made, are going to have huge ramifications, not only in the region, and but on the people
globally. Yeah, and on the, people, yeah, and on the individuals.
That's right.
I think it's also, so this is like me being a huge nerd for fun. One summer I read War and Peace. And like, if you've ever read War and Peace, Tolstoy starts interjecting these like little diatribes about history, and they start out as a paragraph and then they're a page and then they get a little longer. And then you finish the narrative story and there's like 49, or at least in my edition, I'm serious, 49 solid pages of just a lecture about the inevitability of history. And you, it's right at the end and you're like, I am not going to be defeated by a man on a rant at the end of this narrative tale after reading 1300 some odd pages. Like, I will finish this book. But I think that was really formative to me because Tolstoy was very much like, history is inevitable. And I don't think history is inevitable. I think, you know, but for a rain, it was a rainy season. Genghis Khan basically did conquest on seasons, which is how everyone in the medieval era, like there was sort of a campaigning season and a rest season because of weather and horses and movement. And it was really rainy that year in Europe, like right on the border of the Black Forest. And so he didn't go into Europe. He went back to regroup and was going to come back and happened to die. And then his empire got split up amongst his sons. So like, but for a rain, the Mongolian Empire could have marched well into Europe, like for sure, just like a weather pattern thing. So like, I think we think that like history is inevitable. And I think we have this idea because of the way we study history that we're like, this is the fact, this is the dates, this is what happened, this is how the war ended, this is how the war started. We give people this sense of certainty, but I really wanted to remove that and have you feel like anything could happen. And nobody knew the answer. Nobody knew who was going to win that battle. Nobody knew who was going to win the siege. Nobody knew. They were making decisions based on what they thought would work in that moment. And like, that's so cool, because that's what we're still doing. And that's what humans are always doing. And even though we can look in the rear view and like make a nice narrative and say like, this is what happened, this was always going to happen, it wasn't always going to happen. People made a decision and it worked out. And sometimes they could have made a decision and people could have looked back and been like, that was the really, really not a good call for you in that moment. But they didn't know that. They thought it was fine, or they thought it was worth the risk, right? Like they did a risk assessment and they said, we're going to do it.
That's a consequentialist point of view, right? Like it's easy for us to determine whether something was good or bad after it happens. Yep. So it's a wonderful position to be in, I guess.
Yeah, you're like, that's great from your armchair, and I'm in an armchair, right? But it's more fun to make it feel like it's always roiling underneath you, because that's absolutely still true. It's still roiling underneath you. It's still not inevitable.
The only thing inevitable is math. I'm just going to put that up there.
It's true.
I recommend this book for all the reasons we just talked about and the billion more that we didn't even talk about because we did non-spoiler. And there's so much more to this book that we didn't like. Just the whole middle section is incredible. When the band gets moving and they end up in trouble a couple times and they've got to think. And then that's really when the individual skill sets really come out, right? It's so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Another great reason is this amazing cover by Amir Zahn is so awesome. The artwork is so beautiful. All these books are just knocking it out, whether it's the photographic covers that Tasha and Bethany went with, and then CB's cover and your cover. It's just, they're all so great. I love this series so much. They look so good on my shelf.
Oh, I was gonna say, they must look so good together.
they do. Yeah. I assume anything you've got planned for launch day or week will be up on your socials and websites.
Yes, it is. So I'm going to be on the Fierce Reads winter tour. So you can check on my socials.
Oh, that's with Liz Huerta. Yes. And who else? Remind me.
Raquel Marie.
Right.
And Axio. I think that's the four of us. If I miss someone, I'm very sorry. My brain is not always firing on all pistons, but
Axio's book came out today, everyone. So it'll be too late, but please read The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea. It's so wonderful. Yeah.
Yes.
Another great cover.
Yes. Too. Yeah. Oh, that is a stunning cover.
Yeah.
And just a stunning writer. So yeah, we're going to be going through, I think we'll be Fort Collins. We'll be in Houston at Blue Willow Books. So Fort Collins will be at Old Firehouse Books, Houston, Blue Willow Books, Austin, Book People. And then we'll be at North Texas Teen Book Festival in Dallas, or right outside Dallas at the end. That's in the first week of March. And then Los Angeles, I'm going to have a book launch on Sunday, March 13th. So I don't know if that comes out before then, but if it does, at the Ripped Bodice, it's like 2 p.m. on a Sunday, perfect time to, you know, go farmer's market, grocery shopping, come pop, get a book, like hang out, see some people. I think that'll be really great. I'm so thrilled to be able to do events in person. That's what's on the docket for right now. If anything else gets added, I will obviously be promoting it. I'm largely mostly on Instagram. I'm sure some stuff pops up too on Twitter, but I'm more present and more consistent on Instagram than I am anywhere else.
No, I don't blame you.
I try to like email out when I'm going to be places. So you can also sign up for my newsletter on my website as well.
AminaMae.com is where you find all that. I'm super happy for that. I've talked to all three of those authors before, Liz and Raquel and Axie. And my Weenie Diverse Books Axie piece came out today. So
that's so great.
Yeah, she's super cool. Having talked to you now, it's such a, what a wonderful little tour that is. I hope, and it's so nice to be able to get out there and obviously see so people, talk to humans again.
Talk to humans in person. The whole Fierce Reads team, just kept on planning while everything was going up in the air. And I have so, so much immense respect for them and all of the bookstores just continuing trying to make it work, make it feel safe, like do what they can to make a plan while also acknowledging that, you know, anything can come out.
History
can come in and capital H history can come in and always, you know, punch you in the nads sometimes. So
for sure. No, but that's a great group of not only of just good people, but I mean, just amazing, like Lost Dreamer, Liz's Lost Dreamer is amazing. Obviously Ophelia After All is great. And this book is great. So yeah, that's just a quality stacked lineup. So definitely I wish and hope people come out for those. Amina, thank you so much. I had such a great time talking to you. It's the first time we've actually spoken, so I was so happy to get the opportunity to do so. So thank you so much. There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Amina for stopping by and talking all about Travelers Along the Way and everything else. These classic remixes are all incredible, and I can't recommend them enough, so why not start off with this one? The book is out now, so pick up a copy wherever books are sold, and head on over to aminamay.com for more information. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now. And there's no objection.